Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I can't tell you, good guys, what a pleasure it is to have Carl in the house and how difficult it is to get him to come down to the house.
He finally got me down here. Where am I? Kettering, is it?
No, don't say that. It's Barton Seagrave. We're posh. Apparently.
He's all right. Really good. Shitting out on TV tonight. It might be me shitter tonight, so you might wish you stayed at home.
No, it won't. We're going to start right at the beginning, Carl, if I can, because I think that everybody here knows Carl Fogarty, the star of Carl Fogarty, but do you know very much about him? Because if you do, then I'm fucked. Because I've got to start right at the beginning, I think, will be the favourite part of it.
At the beginning.
So where were you born? Well, this will loosen you up.
Under a bush.
Is that the old dog? Up against the wall.
Yeah.
So, where were you born?
I was born in Blackburn, Lancashire.
And went to school there?
I did, yeah. I still live there, still live in Blackburn. They won't let me leave, to be honest.
He lives in a very posh part of Blackburn.
Yeah, we kind of moved up a little bit from the not-so-posh area to, I guess, the posh area. The Ribble Valley is what I like to call it, is where I live. But yeah, Blackburn born and bred and still there. I went to school there, went to work there. And, yeah, I grew up as an annoying little kid who just loved bikes. My dad used to race. Just as a kid, I was always around motorcycles. But going to races like Croft and sort of Aintree, Alton Park, and that kind of thing, sleeping around in the back of the van. And when you got a few more quid, you got a caravan. And then obviously the TT was a big thing, really, for my dad. He did the TT every year as a kid. I got to go to the TT from being sort of 1 year old to 16 years old. It was great. I got 2 weeks off school, which I fucking hated school, so it was great. And all my childhood memories are at the TT, to be fair, all the sort of mischief used to get in the amusement arcades, and Nicky Curly Willie's out the vending machine in the hotel and stuff like that, as you did as kids. And being brought up around bikes, it was something that I always wanted to do, race bikes. I think whenever you get brought up around as a kid, chances are you're going to want to do that as a hobby or as a profession, as it turned out for me. But yeah.
Was there money in the family? Because that's a modern thing, isn't it, nowadays? You know, kids buy rides, they start when they're very, very young and usually start in Spain. Was there money in the family in those days to sort of promote you, to move you on?
Not really. My dad worked really hard. Him and his brother were just to clear out people's backyards and all sorts, trying to earn a few quid to buy a truck. And then he got sort of a couple of warehouses and did haulage and storage. And he did well for himself, my dad, even through just sheer hard graft, to be fair. But he obviously helped me out. So my first bike was his Formula 2 Ducati, which I raced for a few races with an orange jacket on to start racing in 83. And yeah, that was fun. I remember my first race, got disqualified, actually. Finished second and got disqualified for using an electric start. I pulled a number out of the hat, Aintree, number 36 it was. It was like, fucking hell, the back row of the grid. And my dad and all my family and stuff were on the start and finish straight with all the vans on top of the vans. Nice sunny day. And my grandma was there and everything. She used to come to watch us at Aintree. And Dad said, look, don't make it obvious on the start just because you're using electric socks. I could never start this Ducati. I never bump started. It was that small. And as the guy lifted the flag up, I just pressed the button and just went from the fucking back row of the grid right through into the lead. And apparently my dad and my family was going, oh, fuck's sake, what's he doing? And I was led into the first corner from being on the back row of the grid. And I was back to fourth, and I was on the grass and on the back on the tarmac. I was riding a bit dangerously, to be fair. I didn't care.
When did that change?
So back to fourth, and I finished second. I was like really pleased. I'd finished second, my first ever race, you know, with orange jacket on against all these guys who've been racing for sort of a few years and that. And then, yeah, I got disqualified. And I was heartbroken, to be fair, because I made it that obvious that I'd use electric start. That I got disqualified in my first ever race. Yeah.
Dad was a racer. Quite good, quite yeah, handy as a national racer.
He was, yeah. He never had, you know, decent bikes, to be fair, because like I say, he didn't really have any money. He always had second-hand bikes. And by the time his business started doing well, he was in his early 30s, and he bought an RG500 when they first came out in 1977. And had a great season that year, really did really well. He did the TT, was running second in the TT in the senior race, and a storm went through the radiator, and that was his race over, and he finished second in the classic race behind Joey Dunlop, obviously, who was a bit of a legend around the TT. So to say my dad came second behind Joey, it's like no mean feat, really, to be fair. But yeah, he was decent rider. He won the Cocker North at Scarborough, Southern 100. He won that race. He kind of had good success on the roads, it seemed to be, really. At Northwest 200, he finished second behind Charlie Williams and that. So yeah, he was a decent rider, to be fair. Never as good as me, like, but he was all right. He was one of the nicest guys in racing. He wasn't like me at all. I was a horrible bastard I was, to be fair.
But do you think your dad could see that in you, and he kind of rolled over early, or because he was riding, he was still racing when you were riding?
Yeah, well, his last year was, give me this fucking froth everywhere. In 1983 was his last ever season of racing. And that was my first ever season. I remember I did one race against him at Aintree in the 500 race, open class. He won the race on his RG500. I was like 11th on this Ducati. But yeah, he kind of just did that one season when I did my last. I was like 18 in the July of 83. So then I was old enough to go road racing, which I think at that time it was 18. But then I remember Alan Carnes was racing. Yeah. So maybe I'd worked out the years wrong. He could probably race at 16. But I was doing schoolboy motocross at 16. So
it always struck me when I was around the paddock that it was a very competitive family. I mean, Georgina, your sister, I felt a bit sorry for her because she always seemed to be on the other side of things. Everybody was behind you for racing and the like. I mean, was it a competitive family? Was it when you got home, were you all arguing?
No, not really. No, she was. She wasn't. I don't know. It was my sister. She was a pain in the ass, to be honest. My sister is. But yeah, she just went along with the flow, really, to be fair. My mum was never really that competitive. My dad was when I played him at squash or at dominoes. Well, I hated losing at dominoes. He couldn't stand losing at dominoes. He still like playing at dominoes now. He gets really pissed off if you don't win at dominoes. Yeah. But when he was racing, he was never that sort of cutthroat, you know, really wanting to win sort of thing. He just loved his racing, to be fair. There's a hobby for him. But yeah, playing squash with him or something like that, he was really wanting to win. It was pretty competitive then.
So when did you realise, at that early age, when did you realise how competitive you were and how much it meant to you?
Very early. I would tell anybody that would listen to me at 12 years old, before I even raced a motorbike, that I was going to be world champion. You know, I was that confident or cocky or whatever. I don't even know if I actually believed it myself. I think I just said it because it sounded funny or sounded cool to say it. But I think I actually did believe it, to be fair. I think I did. And I just believed that I was going to be world champion. And so that was it, really.
What sparked? I mean, what was? Just, was there an incident that made you think, I can do this? I can make this?
It's just winning that first race at Aintree. You know, when I first did the race, I was like, "Oh, I didn't come last." You know what I mean? And then, I remember when I did schoolboy motocross, I was never really that aggressive or determined for some reason. Maybe I knew that I was never going to be good enough at it at motocross, to be fair. And I was happy just to get a trophy, finishing the top sort of eight or something like that. You know, but when I went to road racing, that first ever race, I really was determined to win it. That determination and, you know, will to win was there right from the first go when I first raced, you know. And when I won my first race the year after on the 250, then it was like winning my first national race. I wanted to win that, and then the first international race, and then obviously the TT and things like that. And I just saw wanted to win so badly. I was so competitive. I just hated finishing second. I hated losing, and it became, you know, I was kind of famous for it, really. Even like the crowd and the media expected it at the end. You know, the pressure I was under to win. It came from myself, but because I said I was going to win, I was going to do this, I was going to do that, and you know, the fans, everybody kind of expected it, really. So it was. It wasn't easy being with Hillary in my head, to be fair.
And I was just about to get there, because mentally that must have been very, very demanding. Was there a sort of personality defect you think you had for this kind of thing? Was it overly aggressive? Or was there somebody you aimed at and thought, I want to be him or her or whatever?
No, I wasn't really looking up to anybody that way. I just wanted to win the races. And you know, the more I won, the more I had to win. And the more I was thinking about that next race, it just became an obsession at the end. In 99, sort of thing, was... I felt under more pressure than ever, and I'd had so much success into up to 99, but it never got any easier. You know, you think I've maybe relaxed a bit and enjoyed the racing, but I never enjoyed racing, to be fair. Not like someone like James Whittam enjoyed racing, he loved it. It was just the winning for me was, I didn't even like racing bikes, I just knew I was good at it, I just wanted to win and win at all costs, you know, and it didn't make me easy to be around, to be fair, especially for those around close to me. Yeah.
Did you have any help? Was there any mental health situation there? Because it's something I've never asked you before.
No.
In fact, I've known you for so long.
No, I mean, mental health didn't exist, to be honest, back in sort of 30, 35 years ago, whatever. I kind of does now, I mean, I suffer from it now a little bit with anxiety and depression and whatnot. I think most people do, to be fair. It's it is how it is. It's the way your life is now. It's so fast. But no, it didn't really exist. I was just mentally really, really strong, to be fair. Back in the day, I would say all sorts of stuff and generally back it up. I look back now, stuff I said, I think, why do you keep your mouth shut, for fuck's sake? Just get on the bike and ride it instead of putting so much pressure on yourself. But it was just the way I was. My makeup was that way. Just to have a go at others who got close to beating me and kind of diss them or diss their bikes or whatever, you know. And I mean, you guys loved it at Sky. It was, you know, Sky Sports made sort of me as a name, made me a household name, and made the sport a household name, World Superbikes. It went behind the scenes, showed all the qualifying, all the personalities, everything, all the interviews, even adverts with me with Sky and stuff. You know, it certainly did a lot for me and my sport. It was incredible. It was, everybody was just all about superbikes, and no one was interested in GPs in the late 90s. It was all superbikes was ruling the world, to be fair.
Well, Superbikes are on their way back, of course, at the moment. But back in the day, Sky was a brand new broadcaster out of London. It had never been seen before, and it had never been done like that before. We were lucky enough to be part of that. For those of you old enough to remember me and Jules that were commentating it on the same time as Carl was coming up through. So it worked really, really well for all of us. And Sky couldn't have been happier. Was there anybody that you kind of focused on that you wanted to emulate, or were you absolutely your own man? There was nobody that you looked at as style-wise or strategically that you looked at that you wanted to be like, or was it just a case of getting your head down and winning those races?
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, I just wanted to be like Kenny Roberts, to be honest. He was kind of my hero. Kind of wanted to be him. And I'd watch others who were faster than me and try and learn from them, alter my style accordingly to get to the front, really, from riding a bit of an awkward style at first and then following others and getting my lean angle dead better and my knee out further, that kind of thing. But no, it was just me being me and me battling with me in my head, to be honest. You know, wanting to win. Even when I won sometimes, I still wasn't happy that I could have won better or something, you know. The bike wasn't exactly set up as it should have been, you know. But still won the race and I'm still furious about it, you know.
You were quick. I can't even say it. I've only had two mouthfuls. You were quick on a small bike back in the day, 250. Broke your leg, and that kind of forced your hand, really, didn't it, to the bigger bikes?
Yeah, I did. I kind of spent 2 years in the wilderness, to be honest, at an age where I should have been, you know, maybe doing Grand Prix or something, like 20, 21. In 86, I was on 250. I was having a great year. I'd done four lap records in four weekends running at Scarborough, Aberdare Park, Mallory, Snetterton. Finished second at Snetterton in the 250 British Championship race behind Andy Watts.
It was Andy Watts, yeah.
I got an entry for the British Grand Prix. I had to beg for an entry, to be honest. And they were like saying, look, you're riding a bit wild, just calm down. Or you're knocking Carlos Lovado or something like that, you know. And it was pissing rain, and I qualified quite well, to be fair. 26th for the Grand Prix, And I finished 11th in the British Grand Prix. I was like, just turned 21, I think I had. And I had a meeting that following week with Chas Mortimer, who wanted to sign me to race in Grand Prix with Neil McKenzie on the Silverstone Armstrong team. And then the next race for me was my home race at Alton Park. And I was like, went there on a Tuesday, testing. I remember taking some old tyre that I'd found in the garage from when my dad had raced an old slick, but it was a brand new one. Put that in because you could run in slicks in an international, and crashed on the second lap, coming out the double right-hander to the back straight. I can't remember what it's called now.
Druids.
Coming out of Druids. It kind of goes over a rise and it falls away. And up in the air, came down, my leg was facing the other way. And I thought, shit, that's not good. And that was it then. I was in hospital for 8 or 9 weeks on traction, straight out with all these weights on my leg. Not pinned or anything like that. It was... We didn't really know anybody could pin it. I mean, it was that close to my knee. It was a compound fracture of my femur. It came out of the skin, everything, the bone. So it wasn't pretty. And that was me struggling then, really, for the year after. I came back and I couldn't get on the bike properly. I'd lost movement in my leg. To put the seat a bit higher, like more form on the 250. And I was struggling on the Honda. My results weren't that good. I was getting seconds and thirds, and from the guys I were beating easily in 86, I was still young and learning. I was struggling to beat them. And then the first round of the British Championships came, and it was wet at Mallory Park. I'm dead comfortable in the wet, and I won the race. So I was leading the British Championship. Went to the second round, and this on the September the 19th, and I broke my leg on August the 19th the year before, and I crashed in the wet at Silverstone and broke my leg again on lower down where... It had been on traction. They took the pin out, and the bone had got infected, and his skin had healed up. But it was a weak point there, and I just had a soft crash and just snapped again my leg there. So I had to scrape all the bad bone out, and put me on a.
Anybody eating?
It put me on like an outside fixation sort of frame scaffold thing, you know. And so that was into the winter. Then of 87 and 88, it was like the doctor said, "Look, have you ever thought about sort of retiring from racing?" I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to be world champion sort of thing, you know, what are you about, you know. And I just kind of dawned on me then what he said, you know. And then it kind of forced me then to go to the bigger bikes, which really were, I should have been anywhere really, even at that point, to where all the fame, the money, the success, you know, the sort of press and that is where the bigger bikes are. And I got on the RC30 in 88, and I just thought, oh my God, I'm comfortable on the bike for the first time in 2 years. You know, like they've got more leg room on the bike, and that little cramped 250. And yeah, I just took to it like a duck to water, really, and rode pretty much 80% that year because I still had my leg that was broken, still healing, really. And ended up winning a few races on the RC30 and winning the World Championship in my first year, which was totally unexpected. The TTF1 World Championship, won the Ulster Grand Prix, beating Joey and all those guys on the RC30, my sort of first kind of big race win on that, and then followed up by winning in Italy, in Sicily, a few weeks later, which put one hand on the trophy. Just had to finish in the top four or five at Darlington, which I did, and won the World Championship. Yeah, it was a surprise to me, as it was to everybody else, really, that somebody who had almost missed a year out of racing and was looking at the possible retirement because of the injuries to my leg, that I ended up winning a TTF1 world title in my first year on a superbike. So
it's amazing, or it seems amazing to me, that there are so many titles that you've won that most people have overlooked and forgotten about by now. You know, the Manx Grand Prix wins, Endurance World Championship wins, TTF1, like you've said, as a world championship as well. But if I can just step back a bit before we get too far into the racing and stuff as well, in amongst all this that was going on, you being as aggressive as you are out on racetrack and the like, I want to know the circumstance, how you met the love of your life at the end of the day. In amongst all of this is Michaela. And that's been an enduring, he's a granddad now, by the way, two times over. We can congratulate him on that. But the point being is that Michaela has been beside you through thick and thin, and I have to say that from my observations, you've certainly pressed her a couple of times.
Yeah, she's a good girl. She's all right, yeah. I met...
She's lovely.
I met her when I was like 14. She'd have been 13, I think. My sister was a mate of hers at school, and she kind of brought her home to our house, and I thought, oh, she's all right, you know.
As she do.
I was more interested in motorbikes at that age, to be honest, at 14. But yeah, that was when I met her, and I think I kind of fancied her then straight away. I was always, but my way of, I'd never admit it, I would like try to sort of pin her down and beat her up and stuff like that and pull her hair and put soil in her face and throw water in her face. My heart erupts for liquid in her eyes and stuff. Just
sort of, obviously did the trick.
Yeah, I don't know. I just
can't recommend it, though, to anybody.
Get her willies and throw them in the stream and stuff when they had the treehouse up above the stream. But, yeah, I guess that was my way of showing affection to her.
What did her parents think of this?
Dad was a copper, so... He didn't like the Fogarty name anyway because he had trouble with the Fogarty name with incidents with my dad and his brothers in previous sort of years and stuff. But he didn't really say much, really, to be fair. I didn't see her then for sort of 14 till I was 21 or 22. I just broke my leg in 87. I just had the pins out. It was Christmas 87. And I often thought about her. And I remember going to a bar in Woodlands Pub in Blackburn and... this girl came over and she said, "Remember me?" And I went, "Oh no." I said, "Michaela Bond." She went, "I said, fucking hell, I thought you were dead." And chat up line, cheeky bastard line. Fucking, I was still kind of pushing and fighting with her. And then, you know, and I thought she looks all right. I said, "You want to go out for dinner tomorrow? I'll have a lunch." And I said, "Yeah, I'll go out." So that was it then. Hooked. Once I took her out, picked her up in my mum's Escort Cabriolet. With the roof down.
How very Essex.
Yeah, that was it. So we've been together since Christmas 87. Got married in 91, had the two little ones, and still married. Happily married.
It is happily married. We spoke to her earlier on, that she's wishing him well earlier on. And the two girls now, I mean, Danielle and Claudia, I mean, always difficult, isn't it, when you have children, especially when you live the kind of life you did. You took them with you everywhere. They came around to all the racetracks with you and the like. How much of a distraction, if any, was that?
It wasn't, to be fair, no. I can't remember now. I look back and...
I can tell you.
It wasn't... It's not easy for me to remember. I remember we made like a little cot out the American motorhome we had, like a bath. Had a little bath in there, a shower bath thing, and we made that into like a cot at night where Danielle was sleeping there with a fan on. And yeah, Claudia came a bit later, so 94. But no, it wasn't a distraction at all, to be fair. It really wasn't.
I remember being
really good kids at sleeping at that.
World Superbikes was a bit that way inclined, though, wasn't it? It was more of a family operation in World Superbikes. People brought their wives and brought their children, whereas in MotoGP, you don't see any of that ever.
No.
So it was kind of par for the course. But one of the funny stories was one day we were all in your motorhome, and the girls are out in a paddling pool outside. And the next thing, Danielle appears and she said, "Dad, Claude's pooped in the pool."
No, I remember.
Funny enough on its own. Carl goes out.
Might have been me, actually.
Carl goes out and lifts the pool up, and just as you might do at home, and tips the water complete with poop, and it goes down the paddock underneath everyone else's awnings. Don't know where the poop ended up. Was it difficult being a dad?
No.
While you were racing at all, or did you? I mean, that's the one thing about you. You are a very single-minded fella. You focus on one thing, and that's it.
I just focused on the racing. The kids. They came a lot. A lot of times, say with my mum and dad, and they were a big help. Or Michaela's mum and dad, they stay with them. So, but when they came, it was fine. It was, you know, if they ever got up in the night, Michaela would sort that out. But they never did. They slept really well at night. They was really lucky that way. But
even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
No, they love being at the races and stuff, you know, being on the podium with me and that kind of thing. Yeah, it's
What fun. About the social life in the World Superbike paddock back in the 80s? I mean, what was did you join in any of that, or was it that typical Carl Fogarty versus Scott Russell type situation?
Yeah, it was a bit like that. It was kind of me against the world, really. I was kind of on my own a bit, really. I just, you know, after on a Sunday night, I'd end up probably with James Whitten. We'd go for a pizza and a few beers, and that was about it, really, you know. I think everybody kind of had their little pockets of mates or not pockets of mates or whatever. You kind of did your own thing, really. But, yeah, I was generally just, you know, I was thinking about the next race straight away, you know, even after I had a really good weekend and stuff. I never really switched off, to be fair. It was hard for me mentally, to be honest. It was hard for people around me because I was just living the racing all the time, yeah.
Was it as political back then as it is now? Was there so much shenanigans going on behind the bike sheds?
No, it's a lot more political now. Obviously, it's a lot more. It's crazy now. I mean, God, you can't even go for a rumble strip now without getting penalised with a long lap and all that kind of stuff. And no, it was a lot. I think it was a lot better in my day. I think there's a lot more personalities back in my day. I think the racing was brilliant. The bikes were amazing. All the factory bikes that, you know, all the manufacturers were putting out were really competitive. It was like mini MotoGP bikes, really, is what they were. And the first of them, really. It was a great time. It was like the golden era of superbikes. It's from sort of 93 to 2003, really. It was an amazing time to be racing.
So about the money, was there plenty of money about back then?
I did all right. Had a few quid. I did all right.
Because you, despite the fact that you play it down a fair bit, business-wise, you moved into other areas that have earned you really, really good money. I mean, you've done quite well out of that. Was there somebody in the background that... You know, there was the Harris Burnetts who looked after the likes of Wayne Gardner and people like that. The, you know, management that were hiding away doing the slippery stuff where we never saw. Did you have anybody like that behind you?
Yeah, I had a good financial guy from Blackburn. Yeah, he was a good mate of mine and still is. Yeah, he kind of advised me kind of what to do, where to put the money and stuff like that, really.
Because you decided to pay the tax in the UK. You didn't do the overseas thing, did you?
No, we thought about it. Kind of briefly going to the Alamanna or Monaco or that, but I just thought, fuck, I can't do it. We've got two girls. I just want them to be brought up in what I call normal surroundings and kind of go to school and kind of, you know, be sort of safe and secure that way, really, not being the Alamanna or Monaco or something. I just kind of bit the bullet and sort of paid the taxes. But there were kind of loopholes back then where if you invested in stuff and the finances, you could save a bit money on tax and stuff, so... We kind of did what we could do, really.
I think there are a lot of people quite glad that you did stay in this country because you used to have some awesome parties. There's no doubt about that up at your house.
That was all when I finished racing, though, to be fair.
Well, I don't know. I can remember one or two when you were still at it a little bit. But and I'm thinking the kids always had lots of friends around. And like your house was a buzzing kind of a place. Michaela always had kids around similar ages to your daughters.
Yeah, I mean, it still is true. It's still a pretty much open house now. The girls have kind of left home, but they're not really. They're still around pretty much every day because Michaela always cooks. She's an amazing cook, and the kids don't cook, so they're always around. And there's four dogs at our house. It's just mad, really. If I need to do a TV show at home with the Foggies, it'd be quite funny, to be fair. But yeah, the both girls are generally at our house a lot, really. And it's an open house, and the boyfriends are husbands now, in Danielle's case. So, yeah, it's all good.
He's still got animals called after old racers that you used to race against. You had two Vietnamese pot-bellied pigs.
I did, yeah.
What were they called again?
Scott and Aaron.
Oh.
Yeah, I wasn't too happy about it. But
Aaron Slight. Nobody liked him.
No, we've got nothing now. I used to have ends and stuff, but the fox ended all that on a couple of years ago. But just got the dogs. That's it, really. We've got, like, a bit of land and stuff, and often thought about going a bit of a small holding again, but I don't know if it can be asked, to be honest. I don't know.
I can't imagine. Yeah, DIY is not your spec, really, is it?
It used to be. I've kind of lost interest in DIY now too. I don't know. I used to be able to do a few jobs around the house and stuff, and, you know, fix the fencing outside and mow the lawn, but I can't be asked with it all now. Yeah. Really.
It's because you've got staff, you see. Yeah.
I've got staff.
Man who does. What about bikes? I mean, I suppose that begs the question as well. Did you ever get involved in working on your bikes at all? Did you ever get, you know, all of us generally when we come up through racing have got to get our hands dirty. How was that?
I did with the two-strokes, yeah. Once you got to four-strokes, my head was gone then. I didn't understand them, still don't understand how they work. But with two-strokes, yeah, I was stripping down, changing the piston rings, that kind of stuff, yeah. I would get involved with two-strokes, yeah.
And mechanics, I have to say that your mechanics were just about as colourful as you were back in the day. I'm thinking of Slick, good old Anthony Bass. Did you were you involved in hiring those guys, or did somebody else do that for you?
No, I wanted Slick to work for me. I knew him through when he worked for Steve Islop, and I got on really well with him, and he was a good guy to have. And I wanted him at Ducati and with Raymond Roche, and I got him. And he obviously came with me in World Superbikes. I had a few issues, to be honest, with Slick, with the Italians, and he kind of always he made it quite clear that he didn't work for them, he worked for me, you know. He made sure I was right. He wasn't too bothered about being too PC with, you know, Virginio Ferrari or David Toyotti or anything like that. He would, you know, and I had to fight to keep him in the job, to be fair, most years. And then when I took him to Honda, Honda said, look, no, we can't cope with this guy. He's just not doing anything right at all. He's just not paying attention to anything, not being a team player. So he was sacked at the second round at Donington. And Nick Goodison then, who was my mechanic for the rest of the Honda days. And I got him back and went to Ducati in 97. Had to fight to keep him in 98. In 99, he kind of changed a little bit. He'd come around a little bit to the ways of like the telemetry guy and that kind of people, you know. He was, because he's still a hands-on mechanic, Slick, with screwdrivers and spanners and that kind of thing, you know. He was never really gone to the way it is now. You plug your laptop in now and press a few keypads, and that's how you change a bike these days, don't you? You don't alter it with a screwdriver anymore or a spanner. So I don't know how he's getting on now. I don't know, but he still tunes engines for the sidecar lads and 600 guys and the Alaman and stuff. So he's getting bigger and all.
I was going to say he's huge. Bertie, you got competition. When you you're working in the maelstrom that was World Superbike back in the day, I mean, did anything, you know, out of the competition, the big competition you had with Scott Russell, for instance, I mean, that was a massive fight back in the days. I mean, were you guys friends or were you enemies off track?
Hard to say, really. We're definitely enemies in the press and the build-up to a race, and in that race, we were really enemies. But then, generally on a Sunday night, we, you know, we'd kind of maybe see him and stuff and have a few beers and, like I say, a pizza in Assen or something like that, or Monza or a Misano. So it wasn't really that much hatred, I don't think. It was more played out for the media, really. The media would want quotes for us before every race, and I'd say, Scott said something like, oh, I'm just cruising, I'll beat Foggy, no worries at all, he's not that good. And I'd say, it's time to spank the yank, that kind of thing, and whatever. So it was mainly for the media, really. I don't know if we actually believed it or not, but they were like two boxes before a fight, the way they built it up, you know. And people remember that now and look back on it and miss it, really, because it's not really like that. And everybody loves each other, don't they, now, since the Rossi era. It's all, everybody loves everybody and smiles, and, you know, they all go cycling together and rock climbing together, whatever else they do, I don't know. But
whatever else.
Back in my day, you know, everyone just kind of did their own thing, really.
Did anything get at you at all? I mean, particularly outside. Were there any influences from outside? I mean, I'm thinking specifically of, well, actually, a very sad just drops into my head when you've had your swimming pool filled in, because there was a youngster that unfortunately, I even remember her name, actually, after all these years, Hannah, who drowned in your swimming pool. Again, one of these kids' parties at home, and Michaela was at home looking after them all. And you won at Hockenheim that weekend.
Yeah,
It was Nürburgring.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was away. I was away riding up in the lakes. And I kind of got the phone call that it's a little girl that fell in the pool and she passed away. And it was hard because they were friends of ours. I remember her dad. He said, "Look, just go and win the next race for her." And it was like kind of the most important race, kind of. I felt at that time, really, I had to win that race, that first race, and I did at Nürburgring, and it was quite an eventful first race, really. I qualified on pole position, and I didn't get a great start, and I was coming through, and then whatever was in my way kind of got cleared out of the way. There was a bit of an oil flag incident going into turn one, and I think Colin Edwards crashed, and somebody else crashed, and it kind of paved the way for me to win the race, and I won it, and I didn't really celebrate or anything like that. And I remember getting a gold laurel wreath. You never got gold laurel wreaths. You got them in the 60s, I think, the 70s. You never got them.
Don't look at me.
You never got them in the 90s. And I got this gold laurel wreath, and I kind of gave it to a dad, you know. So you know, that's kind of for Hannah, sort of thing. But yeah, it was a tough time. Yeah, it was. It really is. Yeah.
One of the things that I think is almost a contradiction in you is that any of these famous parties that Carl's had at his house, you know, it's almost a it's almost like you're conflicted when you go there, because you've got your really old mates that you went to school with, and then you've got the superstar mates that have now moved in on your life a little bit. But yeah, I've always observed you kind of gravitating towards your oldest mates. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, my old mates are the best. I don't really have many sort of famous friends at all. Really. I've never really been like that way at all. And if they came to my party, they weren't invited. They'd probably just get crashed. my mates are my mates from years and years ago. And in fact, we're all going to Spain next week on the trail bikes, 4 days, sorry, on the adventure bikes, doing 3 or 4 days riding in the Sierra Nevada, and that with a couple of lads who have been mates for years. So the old mates are the best ones, really, yeah, definitely.
One of the stories I seem to remember, I don't even know if he's still your mate, but I'm going back years and years, is a fella called Howard,
yeah.
And he got long hair and he was a bit crazy and looked a bit out of control. Did you buy him a tractor for his birthday?
Yeah, I did buy him a tractor, yeah. Helped him out a bit, yeah, I did, yeah. He's still one of my best mates, even though I've not seen him for about 2 years. Howard's just I could spend the whole night talking about Howard. He's just a farmer that he doesn't exist, to be honest. He's just, everything's been cash with him all his life, and he doesn't exist on the register at all. Not how he's going to go on when things happen in the future. But he's just a crackpot at the case, and he's a really good looking lad. He is. He's long blonde hair. He's probably out now. It's long grey hair now, but. And he was a really good footballer, to be fair. He really was good. He should have been centre forward for England or whatever. He was that good. He went to Man City at 12 years old. And, I mean, in the 70s then, when he would have gone, there were a lot of issues at City then, I think. A lot of clubs were bullying and that kind of stuff. And, you know, paedophiles, all that kind of shit. And I think he came home crying. Something had pissed him off and something had upset him. And that really didn't really kick a football after that for a while. And he was so good. He was really good. I mean, there's one or two other lads who made it in my class at school, made it, played for Blackburn Rovers and Sheffield and Bolton, and he were better than them. And he just grew up on a farm, basically. He was just a farm lad. He was just a big, strong lad and was really good at football. But, he just loves his farming now and sheep and baling hay and stuff like that. A few pints at most nights.
Has he still got your tractor?
Yeah, he's probably got rid of it now. I've got a new one, I guess. But I helped him out. Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, like, obviously, you've risen up from fairly humble beginnings with your mum and dad. But I mean, as you went through that fame phase, if you like, and started to earn a few quid, which you have, I don't think you could deny that, even to us. Did you find people coming out of the woodwork that needed help, wanted help, that tried to twist your arm for a bit of help?
Not really. No, I didn't. No, no.
They obviously knew you wouldn't give them anything.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, definitely. No, I didn't. I had a bit of an issue with my uncle Brian.
Oh, yeah.
He was starting selling merchandise when he wasn't supposed to be. And I'm trying to say, look, you can't do this. I'm Cole Fogarty. My name's Fogarty. I'm selling stuff with name. And I can't. So I've got a contract with people and they're going mad at you. And they got quite messy and stuff at one point. And I fell out with him for quite a few years, to be fair. And we've met up, obviously, since, but he sadly died a few years ago. But yeah, he was a character, was Brian. He was the right rogue. He was a lovable rogue. It was Brian. But that was the only time really I had a bit of trouble with this guest.
It does seem to get a little bit loose in the Fogarty household sometimes. There's no doubt about it. So what about as you moved on through into superstardom? I want to go to the racing after the break if I can. So we'll cover the most of the racing and the like from there as well. But what other parts in that early life really stood out for you? What is, outside of racing, what else stood out for you? Was there anything, your parents, dog, other girlfriends that we don't know about that you could admit to, bearing in mind we're being taped?
Nothing really. It was just bikes. I just wanted to ride my bike in the field when I got home from school, that kind of thing. And
were there any other hobbies that you had as well? Or?
No, I played a bit of football at school, but when we got beat 2-1, I took it really badly and the rest of the team didn't seem that bothered. I thought, I'm not meant to be in a team sport because I can't stand this. We was lost and everyone's like, not bothered, you know. It was pissing me right off that we'd lost. And I'd scored a first goal and we got beat 2-1 by another school. And yeah, it was good. I was devastated. I didn't want to play again after that because the rest of the team didn't pull the socks up and perform. But for me, it was just wanting to be brought up around bikes with my dad and stuff. The TT was a big thing really for me. I really wanted to win the TT.
Well, you won 3 Manxes, didn't you?
I won 1 Manx.
Oh, I thought you won 3. Sorry, Bertie, you got that wrong.
I won the newcomers, the Manx newcomers, and I finished 3rd in the open race and set the fastest lap my first year there. But No, I wanted to win the TT and then move on to the world. I wanted to be that guy like Hillwood or Agassin that could win the TT and then go on to be a world champion on the short circuit. I'm probably I am the last guy to do that and probably will be for the foreseeable future. I don't see anyone winning the TT and going on to be a world champion on the short circuits at the moment.
Was there a plan B?
Forklift truck driver.
Had you got that in the bank?
That was about it, really. I just worked for my dad on the forklift truck or whatever, just stacking up steel girders or whatever. I don't know. That was it, really. I was just so determined. I mean, I look back now and think I was so lucky in a lot of ways, even though, you know, I give it everything I got, you know, with the injuries and stuff. And, you know, I just got a few lucky breaks, I guess, and unlucky breaks as well with my leg. But, you know, there wasn't really a plan B at all. I was just always felt like, you know, I was just going to win races and the money would take care of itself. And that's kind of pretty much what happened, really, to be fair.
Either on a professional or on a personal note, any regrets particularly? I mean, I was thinking of your book. You were quite strong in your book, I remember.
I don't know. I've never read it. I don't. I wasn't in a good place when I did the book, to be fair. I really wasn't. It was just when I was going through family issues. I've just won the world championship again for the fourth time. And I just felt like I'd almost had enough of racing, you know, the pressure and to go out and win again. And that winter, 99 to 2000, I wanted to get on with. I felt like my dad over the Brian thing. And then I wrote the book and I was very angry and animated when I did the book, really. And I said stuff that I wish I'd probably not said, to be fair. But I don't regret it. No, it's me. It's how I was. I think the only regret I have really in racing is signing for Honda when I should never have broke up a winning team on this beautiful bike 916. I left it in 95 and went to Honda really for the money, to be honest. And I felt like the bike was good. It was fast. It was faster than my Ducati, which is one of the reasons I thought I'd go there. But I didn't feel right when I was there. Straight away, I'd almost resigned with myself to the fact that I wasn't going to win the world championship even before I rode the bike. I remember saying to Mikhail, I said, you know, I'll win a few races here, but I won't win. I think I might finish it top five. And I was like almost happy at saying that, which is somewhat like me. I don't know why I'd kind of had that attitude, that mental attitude then. I just kind of almost resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't really going to win. And I wasn't that bothered. It was bizarre, really.
Was that all you, or was it something to do with the team or the...
It was probably more me, really. The team, I should have done better. I could have. I just couldn't be bothered with it, really. I just couldn't figure out why I was losing grip mid-corner on the lean angle. Because my style was riding a different riding than Aaron's. He would kind of more in and out. I was coming a bit faster off the brakes and running through the corners and carry the lean angle, the corner speed that I did on the casting. I could never carry it. It was just breaking traction all the time on a lot of corners. On some circuits, it would work great, like at Assen, it would great. I wouldn't win both races. And then week after, it goes to Albacete, where I could really ride really well. Then I was struggling to get in the top five, you know. And so by breaking up a winning team, which I had won the world championship for sure in 96 on the Ducati, I know, but there's no question of that. But I left it and didn't win the world championship on the Honda. I finished fourth. I went down to the last race of the year, because still won it mathematically. Four of us could win it. I was like 32 points behind, but it was a long gap. And I came out and finished fourth and went back to Ducati. And then when I'd gone back, things had changed. Everybody had gone, like the suspension guy had gone, the engine guy had gone. The bike felt like a Honda. It felt difficult to ride. It was the throttle was snappy. I think gone to one injector system on it, and that didn't help me. And the bike felt big and bulky for some reason. And then we never dawned on us until the year after when they said, the tank's a lot higher up than what you remember from the 95 back. I'm like, fuck's sake, why don't you tell me? Why can't we not get the tank a lot lower? I can get off the bike in the corners and that then. And we changed the tank and stuff for 98 or 99. And suddenly it was back again. I was, you know, back winning races and back winning the world championship. But that leaving Ducati and breaking up a winning team, which I was so dominant on in 95, cost me two world titles by breaking that up and going to Honda for what I thought was a better looking team. Because it was well organised, well run. I got a Honda Prelude car for free, and not that it was worth bragging about. And I got a free motocross bike as well. It was like things like that kind of maybe kind of, you know, my eyes light up a little bit, you know. And but yeah, when the racing came, I wasn't 100%, and the team wasn't 100% with me really. To be fair, and we just have flashes of brilliance that year, and then rest time sort of made it mediocre, really. It was not really like me at all. And when I went back to Ducati the year after, I was really determined to win. I rode really hard in 97. I rode too hard. I crashed three or four times out of winning positions. I was leading into Brands, I crashed. Led at, I think, Indonesia, I crashed. I can't remember, two or three crashes. And Albacete, I crashed. And gifted the championship to my good friend and close rival, John Kaczynski, my best mate.
Anybody know all the inside line on John Kaczynski? He was actually mad, wasn't he? Do you know he's a multi-millionaire real estate man now in California? He's a very, very clever bloke, but he was actually, there was something not right with him, he said about you.
Yeah, no, we both clashed pretty much from the word go. Really, he didn't like me, I didn't like him. And yeah, it was like the same old thing again, being an American, you know, another American to hate and to have as a rival. It was.
I think racing's missing that nowadays, don't you, folks? Yeah. I mean, it's a situation where you don't seem to have that kind of rivalry anymore. The Marquez versus Valentino Rossi type situation, whichever camp you're actually in, is a good thing for the sport half the time. Did you enjoy that side of it, that kind of I hate you kind of a attitude?
I don't think I did, no. It was just it just seemed to come naturally to me just to hate people and say things about him and then have to go out and try and beat him. I don't know why I did it. I was starting to say now, look back now, because you get reminded of stuff you said on YouTube and you know, social media and stuff, and people send you clips. You remember this? And I'm like, fucking hell, why did I say that? And, you know, and why did I just get your mouth shut and just get on with the racing? And yeah, it was. But it's just how it was. It was my makeup, and it was just, you know.
From a broadcast point of view, it was gold.
Loved it, yeah.
It was absolute gold. There's no doubt about that. We'll take a break then and have a beer in the bar. Thank you very much for your attention here at the Stirrup Cup. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.